This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are slated to hear from Stephen Morey, the Secretary of the Department of Economic Development. He's been there throughout the administration of Bobby Jindal, now, of course, in its second year of its second term. We will talk with Stephen Morey about what's happening in our state from a business perspective and much more, including rumors that he might be the next president at Louisiana State University. Also, Fred Kaplan, the author of The Insurgents, David Petraeus, and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. And from WRKF, we will have an update on the Transocean Agreement, pleading guilty to environmental crimes. And last week, a civil settlement was reached to resolve the U.S. Clean Water Act penalty claims from the Deepwater Horizon incident of almost 3 years ago. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside our area. It's 877-217-5757. You may reach us via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. In just a bit, we are slated to hear from Stephen Morey, the Secretary of Economic Development, a busy man who's been on the job since Governor Jindal took the oath of office January 14th. 6 years ago? Was it 6 years ago, Kevin? It was 2008, so 5 years ago. So he is now in his sixth year of his term, two terms as governor. So Stephen Morey is a guy who goes back a long way with the governor, and we will talk with him if everything works out in just a few moments. The Mall of Louisiana was closed during a busy shopping time and evacuated after a fight broke out between dozens of young people Saturday evening. That was the big buzz over the weekend in our community. Sheriff's Office spokesperson Casey Rayburn Hicks says she's not sure how many people were involved, but up to 10 people will face criminal charges. Deputies were called to the food court area around 6 o'clock Saturday. Said the troublemakers dispersed to other areas of the mall. No injuries reported. Several ambulances were dispatched to the area, and initial reports of shots fired were apparently incorrect. So, looks like a melee with no serious injuries and no bloodshed, which is good, but certainly not a good thing for this community. And it was part of the national news cycle this past weekend. So the beat goes on in this community where crime is, it's what some would say, epidemic proportions. But this was not, as things go, an earth-shaking development, but it's something that people are engaged with and concerned about. And many people go to the mall who do not go to other parts of town where most of the carnage is taking place in this community. So hopefully this will be a blip on the radar screen. Tonight, Alabama faces Notre Dame for the national championship in college football. This is apropos with our first guest slated to be Stephen Morey. He came to LSU, by the way, on a band scholarship. He was from Mississippi. He was not a football fan, but of course, as we know, the Golden Band from Tigerland is often featured at LSU games, in fact, always featured, and that is what it's known most prominently for, is the performances at Tiger Stadium. And Stephen Morey got a quick indoctrination into LSU football back in the early 1990s as a student. And during that time, LSU was in the midst of six straight losing seasons. During Curly Hallman's era from 90 to 94, LSU lost 28 of 44 games. And this has been the golden age of LSU football. And it all started with Nick Saban's hiring at the end of the 1999 season. From 1987 to 1999, LSU on the gridiron won 76 games, lost 70, and tied 2. That was 52%. In the 13 years since then, LSU has 133 wins, 37 losses, 78.2%. So under Saban and under Les Miles, LSU has improved dramatically and has two national championships to show for it. The first coming in January of 2004 when Saban was the coach, and the last coming 5 years ago tonight at the Louisiana Superdome as LSU beat Ohio State 34-20 to cap the third year of Les Miles with the second BCS title collected by the Fighting Tigers. And LSU has been winning ever since, just not winning national championships, although last year the Tigers played in the title game and lost to Alabama 21-0. Nick Saban is going for his third championship in 4 years at Alabama and his fourth championship in 8 years as a college coach. So there is no doubt that he is the dominant player right now on the NCAA scene, with success stratospheric in nature. And tonight, Alabama ranked second in the nation with one loss to Texas A&M, is a 10-point favorite over undefeated Notre Dame, shooting for its first national championship in 24 years. So it should be quite a game tonight in Miami, Florida, where Saban, of course, had problems as coach of the Miami Dolphins. 2 years his record was 15-17. And those were the 2 years between LSU and Alabama. He came back to the college scene in 2007, and, of course, he has had magnificent success at Alabama, sometimes to the chagrin of fans from LSU. And now we are joined by Stephen Morey. Good morning to you, Mr. Secretary.
Good morning, Jim, and Happy New Year to you. It's great to be with you today.
Well, Happy New Year to you, and we have told your biographical story a few times. And you came to LSU first as a student, as a member of the LSU band, correct?
Yes, I did. In fact, it's probably the whole reason that I'm in Louisiana today, is I got a scholarship to go to LSU and be in the Tiger band.
And you were not a football fan until you arrived here.
That's also true. I really wasn't, but it's hard to attend LSU. In fact, to go to those games, particularly to be in the band and not become a football fan pretty quickly.
And Stephen, of course, was a graduate of the College of Engineering. He's gone on to success, advanced degree from Harvard University. Now not only a prominent member of state government, but quite a family man, productive in his youth. Three children?
Three boys. They just turned 8, 6, and 4. They're the great joy of my life.
And I recently heard that your wife has a degree in journalism. Is that right?
She does. She got her undergrad in journalism at the Medill School at Northwestern, and I'm especially proud of her. We started dating when I was in graduate school, and she was working on her doctorate then, and I ultimately got her to move to Baton Rouge to follow me back to Louisiana. And she actually finished her doctorate at Harvard, her research, while she was living in Baton Rouge and having our first two children.
So a bright family, no doubt, are the Morays. And you have been on the front lines of economic development now for over 5 years. And how's it looking out there right now for the state?
Well, it's looking well. You know, we had our best year for business development since Governor took office last year in 2012. Announced several dozen projects that are collectively going to generate about $22.3 billion in new capital investment, more than 24,000 new direct and indirect jobs. In terms of total employment growth, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Louisiana added 40,100 jobs in the 12 months through November, which is the latest available. That was 30% faster than the South, 50% faster than the U.S. overall. In fact, your listeners may not realize Louisiana is actually one of only six states in the country, including D.C., that have actually experienced employment gains since January 2008. So roughly 44 states or so actually have less jobs today than they had when Governor Jindal took office.
Now, the big announcement of 2012, the biggest, was in Lake Charles in December, and the story about Sasol generated national attention. In fact, I think the story in the New York Times was bigger than it was in most of the newspapers in Louisiana. How significant was this development?
Really, Jim, it's about as significant as it can get. I mean, that project, the Sasol project, the $16 to $21 billion project that will generate about 1,250 direct jobs with an average salary of about $88,000 a year plus benefits. It is easily the biggest single manufacturing project in the history of Louisiana. We believe that it's the biggest foreign direct investment manufacturing project in the history of the country. We could not prove that definitively. We know it's one of the biggest, but we couldn't find anything bigger than that. Just a huge impact. In addition to the 1,250 direct jobs, LSU estimated, I believe the number was about 5,800 indirect jobs, permanent indirect jobs. It's going to represent a new job creation in that region, permanent, of about 7,000 direct and indirect jobs, massive economic impact, huge amount of new tax revenues, both locally and for the state. And as exciting as that project was, it was really just one of a number of exciting projects last year. In New Orleans, for example, GE Capital announced it was opening a new technology center that's going to represent about 300 direct jobs with an average salary of $90,000 a year plus benefits. In northwest Louisiana at the port of Cateau-Bossier, Benchler Steel, one of the big global steel companies based in Germany, announced they're creating a new $900 million seamless steel tube mill and an integrated steel mill. That'll create about 675 direct jobs, average salary about $50,000 to $55,000 a year, plus benefits. We just had a really terrific year with lots of projects announced around the state. The other thing that was really positive about last year, in the last couple weeks, I forget exactly when, but it was in December, the U.S. Census announced that we had our fifth consecutive year of population in-migration, more people moving into Louisiana than moving out of Louisiana. And as you're aware, almost every year, the 25 years before that, Louisiana had net population out-migration. So we're really pleased about that as well.
297-5633 is your number now. This Sasol development, that's an ethane cracker complex, correct?
It's actually two things. The main part of the project is a gas-to-liquids project. This is going to convert natural gas to clean diesel and other clean fuels, and it also will provide inputs into an ethane cracker. So it's a integrated gas-to-liquids and ethane cracker complex that's going to produce primarily clean fuels, but also a variety of other chemical products.
The reports a month ago when this was announced were that the average pay for these jobs, $1,253 is the number I have, $88,000 on the average. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. It's a payroll. I believe the number is about $125 million a year for the permanent new payroll at the site. It works out to about $88,000 a year on average, excluding benefits. So benefits are on top of that. These will be some of the best-paying jobs in Louisiana. In addition to those direct jobs, you're going to see hundreds of small businesses in the area benefit from new sales associated with that facility. And in many cases, obviously, those small businesses will be able to expand and add new jobs themselves.
Now, you have touted business development, and you said last year was the best year of the five that you had been in state government. And, of course, the state, like the rest of the nation, has endured an economic downturn. Louisiana, as far as the natural gas findings that were a part of the success in your early term as Secretary of Economic Development, how's it looking as far as the natural gas development, the fracking that resulted in an economic boon, in particularly in some areas of North Louisiana?
Well, you kind of have to separate the issues. There's both direct impact and indirect impact. I think what most people have thought about is the direct impact, which is the thousands of jobs created associated with the Haynesville Shale, you know, directly in that area in northwest Louisiana. That was a significant boom for a relatively short period of time. But what ended up happening was there was so much capacity, new natural gas capacity, available at very economic prices, both in Louisiana and in other similar types of shale plays around the country, that the supply just ballooned. And so the price of natural gas plummeted from over $10 in 2008 to, last time I checked, around $3 today. And that's resulted, unfortunately, in a significant slowdown in the Haynesville Shale. There's certainly a lot more activity there today than there was 5 years ago, but it's well below its peak. But I think what a lot of folks are missing is that the advent of low, stable natural gas prices is going to lead to, in a lot of ways, a reindustrialization of the United States. And we believe that we have the potential, we're certainly working to position Louisiana to benefit more from that than any other state in the country. For example, you know, any industry that has natural gas as a major feedstock is looking at doing more projects in the U.S. than they were just 4 years ago. So the most obvious, obviously, being the chemical industry. But in addition to that, natural gas to liquids projects like the Sasol project, you know, again, the biggest project in state history, we have other projects we're pursuing in that sector. So that's not going to be the only GTL project. In addition, significant steel industry projects as well. So pretty much any energy-intensive business is going to benefit from this, and we're going to work hard to help Louisiana capitalize on that.
We'll return with Stephen Morey, the Secretary of Economic Development. If you would like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757, back after this 90-second timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. 297-5633 is your local number outside our area, anywhere you may be. Please call 877-217-5757, and you may reach us via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. John asks about your involvement, Mr. Secretary Stephen Morey, in educational initiatives in Louisiana, particularly the governor's agenda last year. Why does the Secretary of Economic Development get immersed in education?
Well, that's a great question. I enjoyed listening to Governor Romer on your show last week, and he talked about a number of things that impact economic development, from tax reform to education to a variety of other matters. And the reality is that education, well, more specifically, the availability of a trained, flexible, high-quality workforce is the single biggest driver of economic development activity. There's certainly a lot of other issues. You know, taxes matter, logistics matter, regulatory issues matter. But if you had to kind of rank them all and, you know, look at the ones that have the biggest impact, it's certainly education, principally, and then within education, K through 12 being the most important. Within post-secondary education, community and technical colleges would be next, and then the four-year college and universities. And they're all important. But the point is there's a bit of a priority level there. So it's something that's a natural thing for us to get involved in. We were very involved last year with the education reform effort. We were very involved in 2008 in helping create the governor's workforce development reform plan with Tim Barfield, who at the time, you know, was the Secretary of Labor. Of course, Tim and I are working together very closely now under his leadership on tax reform for 2013. But as you look going forward, there's a lot of things that matter in economic development, but education is probably the most important one.
You mentioned tax reform and your involvement. That's a topic that is a mighty one. How's it looking right now as far as where you go and what kind of proposals will be presented to the legislature?
Well, I have to tell you, I'm very excited. I mean, I literally have cut down my normal out-of-state marketing travel and so forth for the next few months to really focus most of my time on this the next few months, because I actually think it's a transformational opportunity for Louisiana. When you look at the numbers, if you really look at the numbers of what families in Louisiana actually pay, I don't mean the rates, but I mean the actual payments of families, the actual payments of businesses in Louisiana, we have some of the lowest tax burdens in the country, including both state and local taxes. Not the lowest, but among the lowest for the vast majority of families, among the lowest for the vast majority of business types in the country. But most people perceive Louisiana as being at best an average tax, if not a high tax state, because of the average to high marginal tax rates, because of the complexity of our system. So we have a system that's not really helping us from an economic development perspective. It's tremendously complex. 468 exemptions makes it difficult for small businesses to deal with that, makes it difficult for families to deal with it, and large businesses as well, frustrated with the complexity of that system. So we see an opportunity to actually reform our tax structure, to make it simpler, to make it fair, to reduce the number of exemptions and produce a system with lower, flatter rates that makes us more attractive for economic development, that will improve our business climate rankings, and ultimately that will just make it easier for people to deal with their tax issues in Louisiana. So we've got a lot of work left to do. We're going to be meeting with stakeholders over the next we've been meeting with them. We're going to continue to meet with them over the next few weeks, and I expect what the governor announces here in the next couple of months is going to be very exciting.
Now, don't some businesses benefit from these exemptions?
Well, they do, but it's very uneven. In other words, when you look at those 468 exemptions, on average, it produces very low actual tax burden. But one of the ideas of tax reform is rather than have it be sort of this selective thing where, you know, maybe one industry has been able to lobby for something that's better than another, rather have a much lower number of exemptions and simply have a simpler system with lower income tax rates that everyone can benefit from, both on the personal and family side as well as the business front. And actually, obviously, there's a lot of complexity involved with doing that in practice, but we've been working on this now for several months, and I think that we've got some compelling ideas. And by the way, we're not breaking new ground. I mean, there's other states that have done this and made it work a lot better. We're looking to learn from them, and I think that you'll see the lessons we've taken away from those other states when the governor announces his plan here in the next couple of months.
Now, you say you want a lower, flatter rate on taxes. Does tax reform involve any tax increases at any level?
Certainly nothing by design. Obviously, anytime you make changes to the tax structure, there could be a minor impact on a particular business or particular individual. But overall, most importantly, I should have said, overall, this is going to be a revenue-neutral exercise. So we're not looking to increase revenues. We're not looking to decrease revenues overall. And we're also not looking to, shift the burden from one group or one type of business to another. And so a lot of the work that's involved in this is not only trying to simplify it, but making sure that in the process of simplifying it, that we don't, inadvertently create any unintentional negative outcomes.
But if there is a tax decrease for somebody, if it's revenue neutral, then wouldn't that mean there would have to be a tax increase for someone else?
Well, right, but keep in mind, I'm not saying that we're not reducing taxes overall. Let me be clear. What we're doing is trying to create a simpler system with lower, flatter rates. If you look at the system today, for example, whether it's sales tax or income tax, we have relatively high rates, but we have hundreds of exemptions. So the effective rate that people actually pay or businesses actually pay for their corporate income tax or their personal income tax is much, much lower. If you look at the corporate income tax, for example, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I know that the sort of gross revenue, if you will, of corporate income tax is well over $2 billion. Actual collections well under $300 million. So the vast majority of what would theoretically be paid is offset by exemptions. So if you just hypothetically eliminated most of the exemptions, you could actually have a dramatically lower marginal tax rate for corporate income taxes, same thing on the personal side, that you could offer to all taxpayers, not just those taxpayers that are able to take advantage of particular exemptions. That's really what we're talking about.
We look forward to following this with Secretary Moray and Tim Barfield and others in the governor's administration. Nara in New Iberia, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak. I'm calling in regards, I think this is a wonderful opportunity for our economy and growth and its worth. However, I live in New Iberia, and we live on Lake Pinure, and in Assumption Parish, they have a sinkhole, and we have an issue going on over here for permitting for storage of natural gas, and we've been fighting this for 8 years because of the issues of damage to the people and the aquifers. There are serious situations that are overlooked, and while we need natural gas for growth in the economy, why is it that we do not take the time to do things right as far as protecting the people when doing this?
All right. Thank you, Nara.
I'm afraid I can't really give a very articulate response to that because LED is not really a regulatory agency. We're really more the marketing organization for the state. I believe the Department of Natural Resources is the lead on that particular issue.
297-5633, still time to get in with Stephen Moray. Thank you, Nara. John Williams asks, what is the UPS project recently announced in Gina?
Sure. The really nice project there in Gina in LaSalle Parish. It's a full-service machine facility. It's going to create about 95 new permanent jobs, about 121 indirect jobs, so over 200 job total impact, capital investment of nearly $4 million. One of the things I've learned in my role over the last few years is that when you look at a rural area, sometimes a project that create even a couple dozen jobs is a huge win for them. And for Gina, this is just a really, really big win, significant quality project. The mayor there did a great job of helping to attract that as well.
As you can imagine, I've gotten a few inquiries about the scuttlebutt that you might be a candidate to be president of LSU, president slash chancellor. Is there anything to this?
You know, I've heard that question a few times. Jim, LSU, it would be an understatement to say that LSU has had a transformational impact on my life. It's the reason I first moved to Louisiana. Got a wonderful education there that really prepared me to be very successful at Harvard Business School and other endeavors that I've pursued in my career. It's also clearly one of Louisiana's most important economic assets. So I think that the board is doing the right thing, or did the right thing, to launch a national search to find the next person or the best person to lead LSU next. I guess what I would say is that I would love to serve LSU in a more direct way again someday. The question really is whether there'd be a time when that would make sense for both LSU and for me and my family. Right now, as I'm sure you can tell, I'm totally focused on doing the best job that I can for the people of Louisiana in my current role, which is pretty demanding. So I don't have a whole lot of time to think about other potential future possibilities.
Well, you may not have time to think about it right now, but if the offer comes, what will the answer be?
I'm not sure I follow you.
Well, you may be offered this position. You certainly have to think about it at that point. Have you decided that you might be leaning one way or the other?
Jim, that would require me to be a candidate for the position, and I'm not a candidate at the moment.
Not a candidate, but it doesn't sound like you're totally ruling it out.
Jim, if you ask me today, I think the answer is I don't know. I think that the LSU is going through some important changes right now, not just that impact the main campus, but with the healthcare enterprise, with other aspects of the system around the state. I think there's some very important work that the board is doing, and they've got a lot of work to do to think through who the right person is to lead LSU in the next phase of that work. And I think anyone who loves LSU, and that certainly includes me, wants to see the best possible person in that role. And I think that's one of the big questions right now is, they just started the national search, I think, in earnest. It's not yet clear the range of candidates that's going to come out of that.
For those who are unaware of Stephen's background, you were very close with William Jenkins, the current president and chancellor. He was a mentor, wasn't he?
Well, he was. Dr. Jenkins was provost when I was an undergrad at LSU, when I was student body president, so we got to know each other then, but really got to know him much better several years later when I was out working as an engineer and came back to LSU to work as assistant to the chancellor when he was chancellor. In fact, he actually, in the short time I was there, Dr. Copping, who had been the president of the system, retired, and Dr. Jenkins, as I expected, moved into being the permanent president. In fact, the last project that I worked on for Dr. Jenkins as chancellor slash president at that time was helping coordinate the search for a new chancellor for LSU, which is a really neat experience. That was in 1999. You'll recall that Mark Emmert was the person we selected, and he did a really fine job.
I'm not going to badger you with many more questions on this, but as you know, in academia, people who have PhDs, and most of the people at LSU do, who are in high positions, they quite often believe the chancellor and president should have one as well. Despite your Harvard background and your great academic career at LSU, I don't think you have a PhD. Would that be an impediment in any way?
When I worked with Dr. Jenkins as his assistant, and what I've observed in other places, is the nature of the state university presidency has really changed a great deal over the last few decades, not just at LSU, but in other places as well. Today, a modern public university president is primarily focused on external things like fundraising and legislative matters, both of which have a huge impact on the overall success of the institution. And the vast majority of public research universities, whether they have a traditional or a non-traditional president, presidents today tend to delegate management of their academic affairs to a strong provost with traditional academic credentials. And that's really true either way. If you look over the last few years, it's certainly true that most colleges and universities still select traditional presidents. But nearly one out of five, I think the number is, still selects a non-traditional or selects a non-traditional leader. North Carolina, for example, has had success with non-traditional system presidents for decades. But I think what's important, going to your point, is really to look at it from the perspective of the faculty. And I suspect that some of them would be concerned that a non-traditional president wouldn't respect or understand them because that person hasn't walked in the same path in their career. You know, I saw, for example, how hard my wife, Heather, had to work to get her doctorate at Harvard, and I'm sure that it's hard to fully appreciate that. I think additionally, faculty might naturally be concerned that a non-traditional president wouldn't fully embrace shared governance, which is a foundational concept in higher education, at least in the U.S. So I think those are very legitimate concerns. Clearly, some non-traditional presidents have been able to overcome those concerns and have gone on to make significant contributions to the advancement of their institutions. You know, one of my favorite examples is Bill Friday in North Carolina, who recently passed away. But I think those are very legitimate concerns, and I think those are things that I suspect the board will have to consider as it looks at the range of candidates you know, that they look at over the next few months.
Ray in Prairieville. Ray, you're on the air with Stephen Morey.
Thanks for taking my call, Jim. I always enjoy your program. My question for Stephen Morey is, with Louisiana ranking usually between 44th and 45th, worst in the nation for primary and secondary education, and falling behind also in higher education, wouldn't that be a main concern for drawing businesses into the state in the future? And especially if we're going to talk about a revenue-neutral tax state, when we're behind on support for all education, shouldn't we put more emphasis on education in this state?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, excuse me, I do think education is absolutely critical to economic development. That's why I was so publicly supportive of the governor's efforts in the last session focused on education reform. But I also think that, which is not to say that money doesn't matter, but clearly money is not the only solution. I mean, you can look at many systems around the country. Washington, D.C. comes to mind, that have some of the highest spending per student in the country and also have some of the worst results. So there are a variety of things that go into, I think, producing successful education outcomes. We're focused at LED. We know that's critical. It's not something I'm an expert at. Certainly others are focused on that in a full-time way. But I certainly agree it's a top priority, and I think that's why the governor has put so much attention into that recently.
Well, Stephen, we wish you well, and always enjoy your comments, and hopefully we'll have you back soon. And good luck this year.
Thanks, Jim. It's going to be a great year for economic development in Louisiana. Thanks for having me on the show.
My pleasure, as always. Thank you. Bye-bye. And in a few moments, we're going to break here in a few seconds, but our guest will be Fred Kaplan, fascinating writer, author of The Insurgents, David Petraeus, and The Plot to Change the American Way of War. And for all the headlines about General Petraeus, the full story of his rise and fall is perhaps not told fully until now by our next guest, Mr. Fred Kaplan, and the inside story of how a small group of soldier scholars led by Petraeus plotted to change the American military from within. We'll return with Fred Kaplan after this 90-second timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're pleased to have as our guest now Fred Kaplan, a journalist who frequently contributes to Slate, and his latest work is The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. And Fred is also, I think you're married to Brooke Gladstone, right?
That's true.
Who, of course, is a staple on National Public Radio, and you have followed the travails of General Petraeus, and you, I'm sure, started writing and completed your book prior to the latest developments. What are your thoughts about what's happened to him in the last month or so?
Well, I was able to get in a very brief postscript documenting. I don't know if you know this. I was actually the one who in Slate first reported who he'd been having an affair with. I think, you know, here's the way to look at this, I think. The most Well, first of all, the preface is that I've never met an unassuming four-star general. And if such a creature exists, my guess is he'd be a very bad general. David Petraeus has been a bit more assuming than most. If you look at the most successful things that he accomplished as a commander, they tended to be things out of the box, away from authority, where he's making his own rules. When he took over northern Iraq as commander of the 101st Airborne in the early days of the occupation in that war, there was no command structure. He basically got that city's economy revved up. He vetted candidates for an election, held the election. He opened the university. He opened the border with Syria, again, without any authority, without any permission from anybody else. When he became commander of Iraq, all told, he set up this entity called the Sons of Iraq, where he lured Sunni militiamen who are getting frustrated with al-Qaeda jihadists with whom they had been allied and paid the money to come over to join our side. He paid them out of the commander's discretionary fund, again, without telling anybody in Washington what he was doing. I mean, it was a success. But I think what happens is that when you do this enough, you sort of get the feeling that the rules don't necessarily apply to you.
We're visiting with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Fred Kaplan. His latest book is The Insurgents, and he broke the news, Kaplan did, about Paula Broadwell's involvement in Petraeus' resignation from the CIA in his War Stories column in Slate. Now, as far as the main focus of the insurgents is noted, you talk about how a small group of soldier scholars led by Petraeus had a profound impact on the American military. How so?
Well, you know, before Petraeus became commander in Iraq, in other words, as recently as 2006, the army was basically led by four-star generals who had come up through the Cold War. Their concept of war was large set pieces on a battlefield with tanks and artillery and fighter planes. And in fact, the official army doctrine referred to all other kinds of war, all other kinds of conflict, as military operations other than war. It wasn't even war. They called it mutwa. And a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff around that time was once overheard as saying, real men don't do mutwa. Okay, you take a guy like Petraeus, who is 60, and people in the decade under him, they came up through the army. Where were they stationed? They were in El Salvador, Haiti, Somalia, Bosnia, places like this, where people were shooting bullets and these guys were getting fired on and sometimes firing back, but that wasn't considered a war by the real army. So some of these rising officers thought that they really had to change the army from within. They saw these kinds of threats as being the threats and the kinds of conflicts that we were going to be fighting in the coming decades. The army was completely unprepared for it. And so, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but the subtitle, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War, there really was a plot. There was a concerted effort, a coordinated effort by this rising generation of soldier intellectual officers, most of whom came out of the social science department at West Point, to get into the thick of the army and to change the way around. And to a dramatic and remarkable extent, it worked.
And how did Petraeus, Fred, how did he emerge as the ringleader?
Well, he was the most senior of them, but Petraeus is very interesting. He came up, he was very much into physical fitness, this is well known, leadership. He wanted to be in the light infantry, in the airborne infantry, jumping out of parachutes, jumping out of airplanes, that kind of thing, when the army was, in fact, tilted toward, you know, tanks, artillery, that sort of thing. Very early on in his career, he was stationed in France with a parachute unit, and he started reading some of the literature of French military doctrine, which emphasized something called revolutionary warfare or counterinsurgency. The French had fought against insurgents a lot, and some of these theorists recognized that, look, what is an insurgency? It's not just, you can't fight insurgents just by killing them and capturing them. insurgencies rise to some support because there are grievances with the government. You also have to help the government reform. You have to help create jobs. You have to provide basic services, justice, that kind of thing. One of the French theorists, a guy named David Galula, wrote that sometimes in these kinds of conflicts, a mimeograph machine is as important as a machine gun. Cement is as important as mortar, that kind of thing. So, in other words, it's what we call nation building. So he came back to the United States with the idea, this is the kind of war that I have to start gearing the United States to fight, to be able to fight. And he was a bit savvier than some of his colleagues, a bit more bureaucratically astute, and he rose more quickly, and as he rose, he created networks, I mean real networks. It's no coincidence that at the end of 2006, three things happened at once. David Petraeus was appointed commander in Iraq. President Bush ordered the surge of troops in Iraq and also accepted as official U.S. doctrine a field manual that Petraeus had helped write, making counterinsurgency a centerpiece of Army doctrine. It's no coincidence that these three things happened all at once. He deliberately coordinated it to work that way, using his network of contacts throughout the Pentagon, some people that he'd cultivated in the White House and to develop the back channel through them, and also his predecessors, some of them more mid-level officers on the ground in Iraq. It's a remarkable story about how a small group of people can really turn things around, turn, in this case, one of the stodgiest and oldest institutions in America around, namely the U.S. Army.
Well, the book is The Insurgents, from Pulitzer Prize winner Fred Kaplan, David Petraeus, and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Thank you very much, Fred. Good to visit
Thank
with
you.
You today. Take care. And as we know, the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded off our coast in April of 2010, almost 3 years ago. And BP entered into a $4.5 billion settlement of criminal claims in November. The owner of the rig, Transocean, last week agreed to plead guilty and pay $1.4 billion in criminal and civil penalties. WRKF's Amy Jeffries spoke about the settlement with Kerry Johnson, NPR's justice correspondent, who's been following the case from the beginning.
When the government first filed suit, Transocean denied any responsibility. When did their stance take a turn?
Well, Transocean had indicated in securities filings, corporate filings with the federal government, that it was trying to work out a settlement with the Justice Department, and that effort has been ongoing for some time. But the first hint of a major development came January 3rd, when the company, a subsidiary of Transocean actually, agreed to plead guilty to a single misdemeanor count for violating the Clean Water Act the day of the oil spill in April 2010. And the company will agree to, in essence, negligence for not doing a good enough job on the night of that disaster. A judge needs to approve that settlement, but most people think that's just a pro forma step at this point.
So this case is not yet over for BP, though. The oil company that was leasing the Deepwater Horizon rig from Transocean is still facing civil claims that it violated the Clean Water Act. And that's still set to go to trial on February 25th. Is the Transocean settlement likely to have any bearing on the outcome there?
The big fish in this case, to pardon the expression, has always been BP. And while BP, as you mentioned, had been able to negotiate a criminal settlement with the Justice Department, it's been much harder to achieve a civil settlement. That would include penalties under the Clean Water Act for each barrel of oil that spilled into the Gulf. Some people think that might go as high as $20, $21 billion. And for natural resource damages to wildlife and the waters and the fisheries there under the Oil Pollution Act. And the nature of those damages may not be known for years to come. So, some people are predicting well upwards of a $20 billion settlement there. And that's what's at issue in this case, set to go to trial in February in New Orleans.
So is there anything in the settlement that Transocean has agreed to that points to how big that number is going to be for BP?
Not numerically, but it was very interesting. The day of the Transocean settlement, BP put out a statement saying, aha, we've all along maintained this was not just our fault. It was the fault of multiple companies, including Transocean and Halliburton, which has not been charged by the Justice Department. And so BP has been undergoing a strategy of trying to spread the blame around. That said, pursuant to some rulings by the trial judge in this case, Transocean is not responsible for the oil that went into the water and polluted the water, only for the surface violation. So BP remains the major player with the biggest pockets here in this case.
The settlement that Transocean has agreed to also mandates that it improve safety measures at its drilling operations, such as certifying the maintenance and repair of the blowout preventers that went wrong in the Deepwater Horizon disaster. Could those safety measures become a standard in the oil industry, even without another explosion?
That's a really interesting question, and certainly the Justice Department and the EPA hope that will be the case. The EPA said on the day of the settlement that it's going to continue to work toward making operations much safer, and the Justice Department and Attorney General Eric Holder said this was just one step closer to justice for all of the human and economic devastation wrought by this Deepwater Horizon disaster. But certainly regulators are hoping that this will set a standard in the years to come.
Does it become also a cautionary tale? I mean, what does $1.4 billion mean to a rig operator like Transocean?
Well, Transocean had reserved in its accounts as much as almost $2 billion to resolve all liability from this case. It wound up paying the Justice Department, it wound up agreeing to pay the Justice Department about $1.4 billion. And some people who have worked in the environmental advocacy community and some folks who have been prosecutors of environmental crimes say this number is a bit too low for their liking. They would have preferred to see much bigger criminal penalties from Transocean. BP, of course, paid over $4 billion. Transocean wasn't on the hook for that much. But these folks would have wanted to see Transocean pay out more. And they also would have wanted to see, as they saw in the BP settlement, some criminal charges against individual workers. No one at Transocean has been charged with a crime. And some prosecutors think that's the major deterrent to prevent these kind of disasters in the future.
The other charge that Transocean ended up being off the hook for was also manslaughter, which BP ended up pleading guilty to as well. Even though 8 of the 11 people who were killed in the disaster worked for Transocean, did the rig operator get away with something there?
It's hard to say. It's hard to charge people at Transocean with a crime that were on the rig the night of the disaster when so many of their colleagues perished in, you know, a terrible, terrible tragedy. It seemed behind the scenes that Transocean was arguing to the Justice Department that it should not have to sacrifice current employees because of that. And in the settlement last week, the Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department's Criminal Division, Lanny Brewer, pointed out in a public statement that Transocean workers were essentially following the lead of the two BP company men on the well that night. Those two BP company men have been charged with manslaughter, and they're fighting those charges in court.
Is this ultimately a good deal for the Gulf Coast?
You know, I haven't seen major criticism of the outlines of the deal. There are two ways that money is going back to the Gulf in this deal. First is this. Transocean agreed to pay $400 million in criminal penalties, and $300 million of that is going to the National Academy of Sciences and the National Fish and Wildlife Federation to work on restoration and shoring up resources in that region. The $1 billion Transocean has agreed to pay in civil penalties is a much bigger pot of money, and that's where 80% or $800 million is going back to the Gulf states to work on projects in that region. Obviously, it's going to take years to know just how much damage was done to fish, wildlife, and the waters in the Gulf, and this is going to be an ongoing project for decades to come.
Carrie Johnson, NPR Justice Correspondent, thank you for your reporting. I'm sure we'll be hearing from you again as the remaining claims against BP move forward.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That was Amy Jeffries, the news director at WRKF. Today is the 51st anniversary of none other than tall Paul Dietzel, the man they called Pepsodent Paul, leaving LSU to go to West Point. He was 37 years old. He had won two SEC titles and a national championship when he departed LSU to return to Army, where he had been an assistant. At that time, Army was a plum job in college football. Dietzel was just coming off a 10-1 season. His team had defeated Colorado in the Orange Bowl 25-7. He had said he would never leave LSU, but he left. He came back, got fired as athletic director, then came back again. He still lives in this community, and it's much to his credit that he returned home to the place where he had his greatest success and greatest failure. Paul Dietzel is 88 years old, a veteran of World War II, quite a man, still quite a presence, as he stands about 6'4 and towers above most of the rest of us. That's it for today. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening. Back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.